This is my journey, inspired one story at a time. A library of leaders was created. It began as a journey to learn. As time went on, it began to grow. All it needed was a platform, and this podcast was created to listen, to inspire, to share. I am a storyteller, and this is my journey. Welcome to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. I'm your host, Steve Anderson, and today I'm doing something that I have never done before, which is to re-release an interview that I had done previously last March. It is with Drew Contreras, and I'm doing this today in honor of APTA's centennial celebration last week in Washington, D.C. It was just an unbelievable event with a centennial gala in the Washington National Cathedral, which was an amazing event, and just a whole weekend of other things going on. So I just want to thank the planning committee for putting this together. It was just a fantastic weekend. And thank you to Sharon Dunn, APTA President, and Justin Moore, APTA CEO, for their leadership at a real pivotal point in our association's history. Now, as you know, if you've heard this interview before, if you can hear it for the first time, Drew is the PT who treated people in the White House, had an office in the White House during the Obama administration, and treated all the people that supported the White House as well as Barack Obama himself, and is also now the PT for President Joe Biden and First Lady Dr. Jill Biden. And because of that relationship he has with the Bidens, he got Dr. Jill Biden to come and speak to the physical therapists and others that were at the Future of Physical Therapy Summit last Monday. It was a surprise to all, and it was just such an honor to have her come and speak to us. So Drew was the one who made that happen, and I just thought in honor of him and in honor of the centennial celebration, we would re-release this. And since we did this interview the first time, Drew continues to run his concierge private practice in Washington, D.C., and is also hired on as APTA's Vice President of Clinical Integration and Innovation. So here's the great interview with Drew Contreras, and enjoy. Hi, Drew. Welcome to the program. I'm real excited to have you on today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So now you are a retired lieutenant colonel and in the Army, and thank you for your service, first of all. But
of course,
give us a day in the life of an Army PT.
So I think the biggest difference between what you would normally have as a clinical PT and an Army PT is that in addition to the normal clinic responsibilities, there's also a component that we like to call the profession of arms, right? Like, you are a military officer, and there are certain things that go along with that. Maintaining your physical fitness, your presence as far as acting accordingly because you're a representative, you know, of the military. And then there's a lot of components of leadership that fall into being an officer that you would never have as a normal clinician. So bottom line is, like, your day kind of looks like you get up, you know, pretty early in the morning, usually fit in your physical fitness training in the morning, unless you're starting clinic early. And then, in which case, then you flip it in at lunch or the end of the day. And then usually have your normal clinic stuff, right? Your normal clinic occupation that you would normally think of. But then there's always a lot of additional training things that have to get squished in there, weapons qualifications, maintenance of, equipment and things like that, that, you know, normal people who aren't in the military wouldn't have to do. So the bottom line is, like, the days are long, and there's a lot of responsibility outside of just your normal patient care that goes with that.
Okay. And then you also, have experience of working outside the military in an outpatient setting. So what's different about you treating patients in the military as a PT versus in your traditional outpatient clinic outside the military?
So the biggest difference right off the bat is that military PTs are independent healthcare practitioners. And what I mean by that is it's direct access, in so much that anybody can just come see you, right? Like, obviously you have to make a schedule or have some sort of, you know, mechanism for people to come see you, but you don't need a referral. There doesn't need to be an engagement with another healthcare provider before they see you. And the other thing is that you have expanded scope of clinical practice, meaning you are allowed to order imaging studies, plain films, MRIs, CTs, bone scans, things like that. You have limited access to pharmaceuticals if you need to prescribe them. And you're also able to refer directly to other disciplines. So if you need to send them to neurology or to an OB doctor or to orthopedics, you know, you're able to do that directly and rather than having to send them back to their primary care manager.
Yeah, and I think any PT would agree that, wow, that's how I want to practice. That's the gold standard. And so it's just kind of interesting sometimes when we think of, well, like Medicare is also a government-run agency, and yet it's so vastly different. It's, you know, obviously they're not under the same arm, but it's too bad Medicare can't be like that as well.
Right, and the truth is there's been, you know, the numbers have been crunched. It's been proven to work. We know that the system works. We know that the model is successful, but you know, replicating it would take some effort. And you know, I know that lots of states are pushing for similar practice patterns, but you know, it's a work in progress.
Yeah, for sure. So you're an Army PT doing that on a daily basis. I think you're at an Army base. So how do you get recognized in your position to evolve from working on that Army base to being selected to develop a wellness program for like the Pentagon? How does one get through the system and be recognized like that?
So it's really funny, right? Like I used to, early in my career, I used to think that you had to do things extraordinarily well to be recognized, like do all the extra work, right? Like present at conferences, publish papers, you know, pursue research funding, and doing all those things that were above and beyond the clinical care to kind of garner, like, you know, increased responsibility and pursue more complicated things. But what's really interesting was, I think the reality is that it's the exact opposite of that. I think it's becoming just really, really proficient and really good at what you do that sets you apart more so than doing lots of other things. To be honest, right, I came home from a 15-month deployment, and the last place I wanted to go was to Washington, D.C. to sit at the Pentagon. I had just, you know, I had just done a long tour with the 82nd Airborne. I was very much in the mindset of what we would call like a boots dirty kind of guy, right? Like used to being deployed, used to being with troops and working on that level. And, you know, some of my senior leaders had said, no, you need to go here. This position will kind of groom you for other positions of responsibility. And I fought it. I did not want to do it at all. So the reason I was selected and kind of pushed into that role is because I was really good at fixing people, just really, really good at it. Not because I had done more, I had done work outside of it, just because I was really good at what I was doing. And that's ultimately how I ended up there.
Yeah, that's great. Now, explain to us, for those of us who have never been in the military, when you're deployed and you're the PT, basically you're deployed in Iraq, is that correct? Is that where you were deployed?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're in Iraq, and you know, what's your day look like there as a physical therapist?
So I was the first physical therapist to go with the 82nd Airborne for like a long deployment. And before me, there was a handful of physical therapists who had also deployed with what we would call like a conventional combat force. There were a few that had done special operations deployments, which tend to be small groups, small action, but you know, higher intensity, I guess would be the best way to describe it. But when you're, you know, I was assigned with a brigade combat team of roughly like 3,500 people. So there's me and my physical therapy assistant non-commissioned officer. And she and I were the treatment team for that entire group. So our group was spread out through mostly about 6 or 7 locations throughout Iraq, and probably over, I'm just making a good guess here, about 400 miles, you know, in territory. So what we would do is we would split operations, meaning I would go to a place first, I would evaluate people, get things set up, and then I would move to the next place. And then she would come in behind me, execute treatment plans. If there was something that needed to be modified, get a hold of me, we'd figure that out. And then we would just kind of, you know, have this rotating circus, if you will, of like just going from place to place to place. And the reason we did it that way was, it was easier to move us around than it was to get people to move from their locations to one central place. It seems kind of counterintuitive, but it gets complicated when you're trying to move lots of people around the battle space. And it was easier for me to have a set schedule of like they knew when I was coming, then the people could alter their missions if they needed to see us. And then they would know that we would be there. And then the truth is, right, it decreased the exposure of them. There's a lot less moving people on the roads than just us, right? So let's say that for the sake of argument, you know, I saw 100 people in a given amount of time. Well, all those 100 people would have to get on a vehicle and move to me as opposed to me just coming to all of them. So, you know, it certainly made for some exciting days, you know, and some back, interesting, yeah. Yeah, some interesting road trips here and there. It's really that model that we always in the military talked about as kind of the sports medicine on the battlefield model, right? Like you're there with the team and the team is spread out over a few places. So you just go to the places, but it's still your team. So, you know, so what that forces you to do as a clinician is get super confident in what you do, very proficient, very mobile, right? You don't have all the trappings of a, you know, 2,000 square foot clinic with giant, you know, modality carts in every corner. You kind of have a table and a bag of tricks and off you go. So that's kind of what it's like.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And how long were you in Iraq?
15 months.
Okay. So you come back from Iraq and now you head to the Pentagon. And what did you do at the Pentagon? What was your role to do there?
Yeah, so at the Pentagon, I was over the physical therapy services, but also the wellness and human performance services that the Pentagon has. The Pentagon's a really interesting place. You know, there's no larger concentration of senior officers anywhere on the planet than at the Pentagon. And all these people are kind of stuck in this gigantic concrete building. And, you know, as you would expect, it's a place, it used to always be like the sun is down when you go to work and the sun went back to sleep before you leave work, right? Like if you came in on the metro or the train or whatever, like there was a good chance that you never saw the sun while you were working at the Pentagon. And that's just the nature of it. But the Pentagon is also a place where it's what a lot of officers would refer to as like a down tour, or the Navy would call it a shore duty, right? Meaning you're not out in front of troops, you're not actively deployed. So it's an opportunity, even though you're doing a lot of office work and management, but it's an opportunity to fix any you know, problems that you have or adjust any lifestyle things that you need to change. Because at this point, most people, when they're in the Pentagon, they're career people, you know, and they're certainly in the middle or more of their careers. So now the focus shifts from peak performance to longevity, if you will, right? All right, well, I've got 11, 12, 14 years in, I'm planning on doing 10 more, but I'm not 25 anymore, right? I don't have I've used and abused my body and made my living off of it. So I need to do some things to maintain my performance so that I can keep doing this. And that's kind of where I came in, right? Overseeing services of not only physical therapy for rehab, but human performance services, strength and conditioning, nutrition, a lot of work on cognitive performance as well, stress management, just those things that the truth is, you know, these people that work in the building have never really had a chance to be overly educated on, even though it's something that they absolutely need to keep their performance up.
Okay, and then likely the most prestigious gig in the world, you have the honor of moving on then to become the PT in the White House. So did you kind of have to pinch yourself to make sure it was all real?
Yeah. So the way that worked out was, so I'm a sports medicine guy by training and by, you know, board certification and background. And at the beginning of the Obama administration, there was a massive increase in middle-aged men with patella tendon ruptures, Achilles ruptures, and ACL tears. And that was because everybody accepted the invitation to play basketball with the commander-in-chief. Even if they hadn't been on a basketball court in 20 years, they still jumped out there like they were 18 years old, and those were the results, right? So
right.
So there was this slew of injuries that, you know, and look, these are government officials, and they have, you know, important positions and things that they manage. Just because they tore their patella tendon doesn't mean that they still don't have a job to do. And then it was, hey, can you come across the river and help us out with one or two of these things? Which then turned into, well, here's your schedule, which then turned into, hey, you're pretty good at this. We'd like you to be here all the time.
Oh, that's so amazing. Yeah, I've heard that it was like a war zone on that basketball court with those 30 to 50 somethings trying to look good in front of the president and paying for it.
It is absolutely true. All the stories you've heard, I'm sure, are absolutely true.
that is crazy. So would you say that treating Army personnel is really kind of like a sports medicine approach to their care and training?
100%. So the difference is, right, I think that if you look at what their approach to their jobs, right, your traditional athlete, and then, you know, the term that gets used a lot is tactical athletes, same things of I need to perform, you know, there are tasks that are physical in nature that I need to be able to do. The big difference is, I think that you know, with athletic performance, they're scheduled events, right? You understand, okay, this day is my game, right? Or I've got, you know, X number of games over the season, and then I have a schedule and a rhythm that you can get into. And then that's very much the case for military personnel when they're not deployed, right? So like, same thing, we have a regular training calendar. I know that I've got these events that I have to prepare for. But then when you start talking about, you know, deploying and working in theaters of operation and active conflicts, all that goes out the window. And it's just like a game time every single day, you know, which is immensely exhausting and draining. But other than that part where you just can't turn it off, right, the approach of preparing for it is very similar.
So would you say that the soldier of today is much more fit and ready for that experience than they were 25, 30 years ago?
You know, that's a good question. And the truth is, I would actually tell you probably not. What they're finding now is that the soldiers of today, and again, so let's back up a little bit and let's define that before we get too far into it, right? So what I'm talking about is kind of your young career soldiers, you know, less than 3 years in, who have transitioned from civilian life to the military, because the brunt of the actual forces have less than 5 years in service. So these are relatively younger people. I would say that the average person comes into the military less physically fit than they did 25 years ago. And we have the data to kind of show that and prove that. And that's a change, right? So then what has to happen is we have to utilize, you know, functional teams to get them up to speed faster than you had to before. Now, the other thing that though has changed is combat is considerably more complicated now than it was 25 years ago, right? There are a lot of digital assets on the battlefield and things that require information technology and things like that that, you know, people of 25 years ago couldn't have the capacity to operate without immense training, but where, you know, the 19-year-olds are very adept at those sorts of things. So I think there's just been a shift in what people show up with their capabilities are. They are a little more technically proficient than they are physically proficient.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Getting back to the White House, so you're back there as the White House PT, and you may be treating, or you are treating President Obama. What are the conversations like with the president while you're treating him as your patient?
So I had a rule with President Obama that we talked about three things: sports, the weather, and our kids. That was it. I wasn't there to have political conversations or comments on it. The truth was, he had a staff of people to give him that information, and I was, immensely unqualified to give my opinion on those sorts of things, right? But now, if you want to talk about, MVP races, who should be in the Final Four, absolutely, I was happy to give my input, on those sorts of things. So the really interesting thing, though, is, that served us well, right? We made it a point not to cross those lines. And I think that if you didn't know who he was and you just sat down with him and just started talking sports, you'd have a great conversation with a really nice guy, and you would never know, right? That's just kind of the casualness that he can bring to that conversation.
Yeah. And how would you describe, if you're just going to try and put it in a nutshell, how would you describe your experience as the White House PT?
I think that, so the best way to describe it is that you come to work, and it's like driving a sports car, I think, right? Like the first time you get a sports car, you think, man, this is amazing, right? But then after a while, it's just the car that you drive. And so you have to take a step back and recognize that it's not like that there, but you have to stay away from that. When I first started working there, a good mentor of mine, took me on a tour, and he said, every time I start to get frustrated or I, am kind of sick of things here, right? What he does is he would go and he would jump into the line with the public tours of people who were just seeing the White House for the first time and walking around. And there, people would have just wide open eyes and mouths open, just gawking at where they were. He said, every time you think that, you are not doing something of the highest caliber, or you're frustrated with things, just come over here and get with regular people and put yourself into perspective. So that was kind of what you had to do, right? Because it's a job to do, and you're there to do, whatever your slice of the day is. You just got to keep it in perspective of just where it is and what you're doing.
And you don't just treat the president, at the White House. You got the whole team that supports him that you're dealing with all the time.
And not only that, right? But it's everybody on what they call the 18 acres, right? So whether it was, the groundskeepers, the electricians, people in the kitchens, or the uniform Secret Service, or the presidential protective detail guys, or the drivers, like whoever was on the compound, it's fair game for me to see.
And what, how would you describe, I'm just curious as to what the mood or the attitude of the people that work in that environment are. Are they just everyday people and loving what they're doing, or is there a bit of arrogance, because look at where I am? How would you describe the people in that setting?
I think the best way to describe it is that I would say 95% of people have a healthy respect for where they are and what they're doing, whether they're the guy who's patching drywall, right, or the person, you know, in front of the Situation Room. I think there you can't escape it. You can't help understanding the enormity of it. But I don't think it's a level of arrogance, as I think it's more a sense of pride, right? That you were there working in the nation's home, and who wouldn't want to take a stab at that, right? Like who wouldn't want to be there one day, you know, kind of seeing what that world is like. So I think that, you know, a healthy respect for it and pride is how I would describe it.
And I know you spent a lot of time traveling with the president on Air Force One. So after the luster wears off, what do you do to pass the time on those long trips? I mean, who do you hang out with? What's it like on those?
So what's really interesting is I actually work a ton. Well, I did. I worked a ton during flights, right? Because the thing is, on a flight, right, all these exceptionally busy individuals are now, you know, in a tin can with no phone and nobody to demand their schedules. Yes, they could make phone calls, or they still have work that they can do, right? But they're just not being constantly interrupted. So they have time where they can have things addressed. And that was actually probably one of my busier times. So I was actually kind of like the reverse of a lot of the team, right? A lot of the team's job was to work while we were on the ground. You know, I certainly had things that I would do and take care of, but while we were flying, I was usually working.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And then when you were on the ground, were you like a tourist in these exotic places, or did you have to stay pretty close to home?
Right. So the way we referred to everything was the bubble, right? Like, did you stay in the bubble or did you get out of the bubble? And I'm not going to lie to you. There was an occasion or two where I got to escape the bubble to see something, you know, like we were in India and I got to see the Taj Mahal, right? A lifetime experience,
yeah,
right?
So, amazing, yeah.
Like just amazing to do. So absolutely, right? But there were also a lot of times where, you know, we would land, I would get to wherever it was we were going, and I would immediately start working because the advance team or the people who were ahead of us, you know, had gotten injured or somebody needed something. And then I would be working just, you know, nonstop. And the other thing is you work opposite the schedule sometimes as well, right? So early in the morning before the schedule starts, late in the evening after the schedule's over, you know, you're just kind of 24/7 availability was the demands of the job.
And how about I think you were married and had kids at this time. How that must have been tough to be away from them. And
So yeah. You know, it very much is like the old Army saying of, if you were supposed to have a spouse, they'd issue you one. You know,
yeah.
Luckily, you know, I married an amazing woman who is incredibly independent and capable, and great kids, and it worked. You know, we made it work. I missed some birthdays and little league games and soccer matches and stuff, but you make up for it as best you can. I think the thing though that really helped was you know, so I'll share a personal occasion just to kind of put it in perspective.
Yeah,
like,
please do.
You know, I'd been working there for a while, and, you know, my wife had never met anybody or even, you know, had only been to the White House on a tour, but had never, like, spoken to anybody. So as far as she knew, right, like, I was just gone, and there was no interaction for her to understand kind of what I was doing. So we're in line for a Christmas picture, right? We're at a Christmas party with the kids, and we're going, and we're standing in line to see President Obama and Michelle Obama. And my wife had had a foot fracture from running, right? And so she had just healed up and squeezed her foot into a shoe, and she was pretty, you know, miserable about being in shoes. But you know, she's gonna wear nice shoes for her dress. So we're standing in line, and she's, you know, kind of frustrated at everything. This whole process, because you're standing there forever, you know, with 200 of your closest friends, you don't even know anybody, but you're in line, you're going to go. So, you know, we're standing in line, and they kind of call the next person. Yeah, the person shuffles up there, they shake their hands, they smile, they take a picture. It's about a 15-second interaction, and then off they go. So as we go up there, you know, they call my name, you know, Drew. And you know, the president's like, Drew, get over here. And the first thing, it's like, oh my gosh, Drew, is this your wife? Oh, look, your foot, you got a shoe on. Drew told me you broke your foot. And this whole interaction occurs. And my wife is kind of like just in shock. She doesn't know what's happening. And so like, but then like there's people like handlers who are like, okay, that's enough. Get your picture. All right. You gotta go.
Yeah.
So then we get ushered out, you know, you get shoved out of there. And my wife's like, what just happened? I'm like, what do you mean? She's like, she knew about my foot. Like they knew who you were. I was like, baby, like I come, this is what I do. She's like, yeah. No, but they actually knew who you are. And so then I think she understood like a lot of people don't, I guess, always understand that our profession is so personal, right? You spend time with people.
It so is. Yeah.
Right? Exactly. So when you're working with people, they get to know you, you get to know them. And then that's kind of what makes the profession unique is that, you know, I'm not spending, you know, 6.5 minutes and out the door with the next patient. So I think, you know, that goes a long way to making things better, and making things understandable for the family, but, absolutely, you know, it certainly took its toll on us, but, you know, we were all happy at the end of it.
Thanks for sharing that. That's a great story. So who was the most surprising or interesting patient that you treated, other than the president while you were at the White House?
So I will not name a name, but there was an occasion where we were overseas, and I was asked, like, hey, this other foreign leader has this issue. Can you see them? And I was just like, is that okay? Like, I don't know. How does this work? How do we do this? So it was just really kind of crazy to think that, like, you know, and again, this was not a significant anything, right? This was just like, hey, you know, what should I do about this thing? But just an interesting thing to think that, like, here's me with no foreign relation experience, kind of being put in this position of like, well, I hope I use the right address. I hope I do things the right way. You know, you don't want to like cause a scene. But then, you know, I think the thing it really taught me is you treat everybody the same and it's probably okay, right?
Yeah,
if you do the best you can and you're good with people, then and it just kind of goes that way.
Yeah, if you're on the evening news, you probably didn't do something right, huh?
That's exactly right. You know, there's a lot of times when people would say to me, like, well, how do you know if you were doing a good job? How do you know, what is your measure for success? You know, and while I was there, I was like, have you ever heard of me? Have you ever seen my name in the post? No, good. Then I'm doing a great job.
That's great. Now, I heard someone once who was close to President Obama when asked, what is the president like? He answered, intellectually curious. And I'm just wondering how you would describe, from your observations, what is President Obama like?
You know what he's like? He's like the kid that's in the class that everybody thinks isn't paying attention, but he already has all the answers and has moved on to the next level of things. And like the kid that just like blows the bell curve, right? He's that guy. He's the one that, but you just don't know it because he's so, he's so approachable in so many ways that people lose that concept that like, he's just he's a big brain guy, right? He's a huge intellect. So I would absolutely agree with that. The other thing I would say is that he's a huge trash talker, whether it's basketball, cards, checkers, like, I don't care. He is a trash talker. So
that's really interesting. You know, with someone as high profile as obviously Barack Obama, And you developed this relationship with him. Do you ever feel like you could ask him to introduce you to someone who could maybe help you with a business issue or perhaps leadership development or something like that? Or is that just off limits?
So I think that two things. I think that I always have to remember, like, and I think this is true for anybody that works in kind of these things, right? Like, we are not friends, right? His friends are Bruce Springsteen and Tom Hanks and folks like that. Like I am not his friend, right? I work for him or with him. And so, you know, if there's opportunities where those things kind of happen organically, so be it. But I think that if you are pursuing those types of things, that's probably not advisable. You know, another friend of mine who works with pro golfers has a saying of like, if you want to be around a long time, don't be around all the time.
Yeah, that's great advice. So let's switch gears here a little bit. And in relation to leadership, do you feel like your military experience has made you a better leader? And if so, how?
Oh, without a doubt. I think that in the military, more so than any other setting or place, when failure results in, you know, catastrophic injuries or just awful consequences, right? The burden is much higher than, hey, you know, we're a little light on payroll this week, right? It's just a different level. So I think that understanding that when you make decisions that affect other people's lives and their families' lives, and the gravity of that makes you really cement your decision-making processes and the way that you approach things. So that's, I would say, the understanding that how much is on the table, you know, when you're working with the military is absolutely understandable. And then it separates that out from I would call other levels of leadership. But the other thing that really I think is also differentiates it is that there's a level of inescapability of your decisions, meaning like you know, when you're in a cohort of people that are around each other, you know, 24 hours a day, there's no facets of your life that are not on display for everybody, right? So if you've got, you know, personal problems that you're dealing with, it's on display. If you've got, you know, problems at home, it's on display. And not saying that, you know, people can't have struggles or difficulties, but how you deal with them, you know, and how you share them with other people or how you let them affect your decision making is on display all the time. And likewise, your subordinates beneath you, all that portion of their life is also there, and you have to deal with it. So I think that's a little different, you know, than typical traditional leadership roles, and I think that makes you a better leader.
I've always been intrigued with as much military experience as you've had in growing up in that system, so to speak. But now that you run a business in civilian life, do you lead your team or manage your staff in a different way?
You have to take into context that you know, people are not that in a civilian setting, like when they go home, right? You're not calling them up and telling them, sorry guys, I know you were supposed to go on vacation, you need to cancel that. We're going on a 2 month vacation with each other without your family to somewhere nasty, right? Like so your approach has to be completely different. You don't have that level of authority with people. I think that leadership, for me now, what I've realized is it's not as much a command style of leadership as it is a consensus and persuasion type of leadership of letting people know what you're thinking. This is my approach. These are the agreed upon goals. This is how I think we can best get there. If you have a different opinion, I'm happy to hear it. I think entertaining other people's ideas and concepts is extremely valuable because, you know, a lot of times there are people who have more experience than you or people that just their point of view is different or something that you haven't considered can help out quite a bit. So I think that, you know, taking that into consideration more so than you would in a military setting is important.
Very well said. Now I understand that you run a concierge private practice in the Washington, D.C. area, I believe. And who are your clients? I mean, do they come to you for privacy? I know you're kind of a humble guy, so are they willing to just pay a premium for your expertise and your reputation?
You know, it's interesting, right? Like, I guess my answer to that would be, I work with people who have scheduling insecurity or concerns. You know, everybody gets privacy, so I like to say, like, I don't, you know, like, whether I was, you know, slinging patients at a small outpatient clinic, you know, I would still give everybody the same level of privacy. But I think that the bigger thing is scheduling, right? So people who have these complicated positions, their currency is not money. Their currency is time, right? That's the thing that they don't have enough of. And when, you know, I see people, you know, I'm also not like charging exorbitant amounts, because I think that that's not necessary. I think that, you know, I need to be compensated, you know, for anybody who does a good job. But the thing is, like I said, is, you know, finances aren't their concern, it's time. And then the other thing is, you know, my approach tends to be, I'd like to clean things up with whoever this person is that I'm working with as quick as possible, in as few of visits as possible. And I say, you know, you're not paying me for the time that I'm here. You're paying me for the time you didn't have to go somewhere else.
Yeah, that's interesting. So when working with celebrities or these high level people, what do you find is the biggest thing that the public has wrong about them?
I think that people in these high profile people tend to, you know, like always, right? They get put on these pedestals, or people have preconceived notions about who they are based on their public persona. And I would tell you, like, that's a bad way to go into it. Like, you don't really know somebody until you have got first person experience, is how I would describe it, right? Like, you can't judge somebody solely on the way they voted on something, or, you know, a tweet they made about something, right? That's just so I think that people like to jump to narratives and conclusions with these high profile people, and don't really get a chance to see the whole person, right? And it's like anything, though, right? Like, it's just like any athlete. Do you really know everything about that person? You know, do you even know, like, their home situation, what it was like for them? So I think people just kind of jump to these things, and I think that that complicates things. So I think the best way to go about that is to just kind of take the approach of take everything at face value when you start working with people.
And do you get asked to do things or be places or do things above and beyond that you just have to say, no, I can't do that?
You know, the truth is, this is how I would say it. I like to work with people that are have a defined need and something that I can help them with. I'm not interested in just hanging out with people, right? Like, I'm not trying to make more friends or whatever, right? I want to do my job, do a great job. But I'm not really looking for, you know, doing things kind of outside of that. And I think that's probably, as bizarre as this sounds, probably not the norm. I think a lot of people are interested in the trappings of doing these sorts of things. And if that's your interest, then you probably won't do it for very long.
Yeah, I know there's, you know, people that work with professional athletes, and sometimes they develop this bond and they just feel they're so much a part of, you know, their success that they want them there all the time, and they want them to travel with them, and they want them to be there when they need them. And you know, you just can't do that when you got a practice to run and family to be with, and you know, so yeah, that can be tough.
No doubt, right? Like, if I wanted to, you know, be trotting around the globe still, right, I wouldn't have retired, right? I was at the point where, like, you know, I wanted to enjoy my family and my kids, and be able to practice the way I want and do the things that I want to do, and say no to the things that I don't want to do, So I think that's a healthy approach now.
Yeah, definitely. Is it hard to stay motivated, inspired now that you're kind of out of that spectacle of that White House environment and that high profile, place that you were?
I don't think so for me, because for that whole time, like, here's a great example. Like, I shut down every social media account I had the entire time I was there. I pretty much dropped off the map. And now, that's not the case now. And so for now, I see like so many things that are happening, and there's so many opportunities to engage, and so many things that, like, I can have an opinion on it now, right? Like, it's, I'm just Drew. I can, outwardly say the things I want, or get engaged on projects. Things that I see where I think I can be helpful, or I can, have a position of leadership where I can help things out, or influence, or set things up for the next generation. Those are the things that interest me now at this point in my career. And I feel like now I have an opportunity to do those things. So I'm going to take advantage of it.
Yeah, that's great. So tell us a little bit about your PT practice that you own and run now. So is it just you, or do you have multiple therapists? Just kind of give us a little feel about what your practice is like.
Yeah, I mean, it's just me, right? And the way I would say it is, it's very similar to the way I learned to practice while I was deployed, right? Bud said, now I don't have an armored truck. I just have, a nice SUV. So, there's no, I don't have to wear body armor, when I go into places. So that's always a plus, but very much still the same where, I got a table and a bag. There's occasion where I need stuff that I don't have with me, or I need to set up, but that's rare. I think that's also what makes, me a good asset for people who have scheduling concerns. The other thing is, a lot of people that I work with already have trainers, right? They already have, maybe they already have a home gym. They've already got all this stuff. They already have a yoga instructor. So all I'm doing is falling in on, the structures that, and the things that they already have in place, and then coordinating with their personal trainer. Hey, listen, we've got the shoulder problem. Do you think we could avoid A, B, and C for the next 6 weeks while I do this? That'd be awesome. Great. And then, hey, here's a few things I'd like to fold into the normal workout program that you're doing. And that works really well. Same thing if it's like, I need to, talk about if they're normally like a, things are different now, but like, let's say they were a spin class or like a yoga class person, like, kind of giving them some guidelines of, these are the types of things you should look for. These are my recommendations. So again, like they already have lots of assets. So I don't need to be asset heavy like a typical clinic would be. So just kind of a different way of doing things.
So how long have you been retired from the military now?
Let's see, 1 year and 24 days.
Oh my gosh. So you're still, this is still new. This is still new. So
it's still super new. Yeah.
Yeah. So what do you miss about the military?
So I think that I miss some friends, right? And I still obviously stay in touch with them, but it's never the same as when you're working together. I do not miss, some of the red tape, right? The military, if anything, has its rules and regulations. And I think that rules and regulations are great when you're not sure of where you want to be, right? Or what your limitations should be. But I think when you get to the point where you know what your limitations are and you know what your capabilities are, you want to be able to, at least I personally want to be able to work up to my maximum capabilities. And that wasn't always available, in a military setting. But I do miss working with young soldiers, which is really weird, right? Because I spent years of my life doing that. And I think the reason I miss it is you see kind of like what's really good about our country. And you see like people that just genuinely are there because it's pure still, right? They're still unjaded. They still believe in why they're there and what they're doing just to their fullest capabilities. So like working with people that are motivated for those reasons is just really humbling. So I do miss that. I'm not going to lie.
So now you're in this new private practice and you're kind of doing your own thing. What do you want to do in the future? What are your ideas and visions that excite you?
I think there's a couple of things that you know, I see on the horizon that I could absolutely be involved in. You know, one of them is I saw this statistic. I don't know, it was probably like 3 or 4 months ago, that only 3% of physical therapists were minorities. And that just staggered me, right? Like, I'm a mixed race kid from Cleveland, and you know, that just is hard for me to wrap my brain around at times when I think about that. But
yeah, it's just it's crazy. It's just, I mean, you know, it's when we look at our profession and how non-diverse it is, I agree with you. It's shocking.
Yeah, and so it was. So when I kind of, you know, again, a year ago or so, kind of put my foot into the social media platform, you know, like, look, I don't think I have anything, you know, all that startling to say, but the amount of people of diversity that have reached out to me and said, hey, you know, I appreciate who you are and where you've been, and that makes it easier for me to come up and do what I want to do. Like, that was really surprising to me. That was really shocking for me to hear that. So I think that that's something that, you know, as now, you know, I'm certainly, you know, on the back half of my career, if you will, right? I think that that's something that needs to be, you know, addressed in some way, shape, or form. I don't have a great plan. I don't have a great idea, but it's just something that like stuck to me, and I thought about a lot, and just realized like that's something that needs, you know, if I can lend a voice to that, that would be good. I also think that, you know, I think that I have just an approach of how to kind of just be really good at what you do, be humble in your efforts, and then, you know, the rewards will come. But I think that that's not always the case with some of the folks in our profession. I think that there's a lot of people that want to reap the rewards but haven't put in the dues yet. And I don't know if that's a construct of, you know, where the education is now or where the treatment of clinicians is now. Like, I don't know, right? But I think that there needs to be some kind of rebalancing of that a bit. You know, and then to be honest, I think that anything I can do to help people out and kind of show people that, you know, there's lots of opportunities out there, and however you go about doing that, I'm happy to help.
Now, you mentioned that you're from a mixed-race family, so tell us about your parents and their backgrounds.
Yeah, so my father's a Pacific Islander, and, you know, my mother's a daughter of an Irish potato farmer from Ohio, right? So, like, super weird. You know, my father was a Navy chief, and he ended up finishing his career at a station in Cleveland, some shore duty station, and that was kind of it. So, but you know, growing up in the early 80s, you know, of a brown colored skin kid in a white kind of working class area, yeah, I certainly was aware of it, but it wasn't, you know, oppressive per se, right? But then I think that as I've gotten older and really understand the difference, like, you know, a good example is we never really had anything to do with my mother's side of the family growing up. And I never really understood why, right? And it wasn't until I was much older that, you know, my mother kind of explained to me that her family thought she had married a black man So they basically, disowned her. And then, 15 years later, when they found out he was an islander, they're like, "Oh, that's okay." And then they wanted, right? My mom's like, "Well, it's kind of late now, right?" But like, as a kid, like I didn't understand, but then now as an adult, like I can completely understand. Wow, they were just a bunch of racists, but so like, understanding that is just kind of interesting, right? But then, so I think that certainly, it shaped kind of who I am, no doubt, for sure.
Absolutely. They must be so proud of you of all you've done and accomplished.
Yeah, I think so. I'd like to think so. Yeah.
Well, Drew, usually at this time of the interview, I ask all my guests a common question, and that question is, in relation to leadership, what pearl of wisdom can you leave with us today?
I think that the best thing I could tell you is, as a leader, be where you're supposed to be, right? And by that I mean, if you are supposed to be somewhere on time, be there, right? As a leader, right? Don't misjudge the value of other people's time. And the other part to that is, be wherever you're supposed to be mentally as well, right? And now even more so than ever, if you're supposed to be, listening to somebody who you're working with's issue or concern, you need to be fully engaged in that, right? And not just there present physically, but off somewhere else. And likewise, right? Like if you're supposed to be at your kid's game, then you need to be at your kid's game, and that's something that I had to learn is like, there are some things that you will not get back. Those moments in life you won't get back, and if you're supposed to be there, be there. The phone call can wait, the text message can wait. It'll still be there for you. Being around people of immense, influence and power has really taught me that of like, there's nothing, that doesn't have its proper place. If it's a true emergency, you'll know it, right? The building's on fire, right? Like it's not, but no text message, it can't wait for just a little bit if you're supposed to be doing something else at that moment. So I think that, be engaged, be where you're supposed to be. And I think that that will serve you well.
Well, well said, well said. Well, Drew, this has been just a fascinating discussion, and I'm glad we got to know each other a little bit on this discussion, and I look forward to interacting with you again in the future. I think you've got a lot to offer our profession, and your experience is just really impressive. So thanks for doing what you do and being who you are, and good luck in the future with your new practice, and hopefully we'll see you down the road.
Yeah, thank you, and thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. To listen to all my interviews, subscribe to Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and many other popular podcast platforms. Some of these interviews are on video, and you can search YouTube for Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson. You can also access the entire library of interviews on my website, orange.coaching.com, and that is orange, the word, .coaching.com, and go to the Media Center and click on Podcasts or Video Gallery. You can also enter the website from pilpodcast.com.